This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Oklahoma 3rd District Representative Frank Lucas. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Congressman Frank Lucas next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. After struggling to lead the Congress in 2014 to write a new farm bill, Oklahoma 3rd District Representative Frank Lucas is again on task on the Agriculture Committee working for new farm policy. On the sidelines of the American Farm Bureau Convention last week in Salt Lake City, where he was awarded for his service to the industry, Lucas said the political landscape in Washington is most challenging to write a new food and farm bill.
Because you see, we're dealing with a kind of chaos in the House of Representatives trying to fund the federal government that's made everything for the last year plus hard. And farm bills are the hardest of the hard because it's real policy. And it's not just sound bites on the late night talk shows. It's real policy issues that affect families and producers and consumers all around the world. So what's the challenge now? We are operating under a second temporary funding of the entire federal government, something called the CR. It begins to run out in March. We need to fund the federal government for the rest of the year when that expires at the 1st of March. Not just because we need stability at USDA and all the agencies that spend those annually appropriated dollars, because not everything in the Farm Bill is a five-year fund. Lots of things are done on a year-by-year basis. But we need some political oxygen so we can then focus on other things. And we need for leadership, once the funding is determined for the rest of this year, to be able to tell us how much money we have to write the next Farm Bill. Everybody knows out in the countryside that inflation has driven down the purchasing power of the things we sell. Everybody knows that inputs have gone up dramatically since the trade wars and COVID. They've come down in a few areas, but we're still paying dramatically more than we did. If we just had the farm bill we had in 2018, that doesn't leave a strong enough safety net. So in my opinion, we need somewhere between 70 and 100 billion more dollars to make the Farm Bill as strong going forward as it was when the last one was signed in 2018. Where does that money come from? The Biden administration, when the Democrats were in control of the House and the Senate, passed massive amounts of money, more money than they can spend, more money than they knew what to do with, more money than with goals that were not really rational. If we could reallocate some of that, we'd be okay. But for some reason, Chuck Schumer doesn't want to do that, or a variety of other Democrats. So if we can't reprogram that, then we have to have some commitments and new resources. If we can get that, then we can do the Farm Bill. What happens if we can't reallocate money, if we don't get new money? Where are we at? I'd rather extend what we have than pass a five-year Farm Bill that would have a weaker safety net. So yes, Jeff, I just said, if I can't have the resources to make what should be the 2024 Farm Bill as strong as the 2018 Farm Bill, then let's extend one more time the 18 Farm Bill to 25, and let's fight over those resources, and let's explain why we have to have it. So everything's up in the air.
If this is extended, is it an adequate safety net to protect agriculture?
No.
Or is it just the best
no.
we can do?
It's the best we can do for 12 more months. But if you pass a new farm bill that locks in what inflation and the cost have done to producers, then you've got 5 years of misery. I'd rather have one more difficult year if I can get five good years than to have 5 years of this.
What's our chances?
Again, I'm an eternal optimist. I believe that you've got several pieces moving in our direction. One, you've got a president running for re-election. Every president in my lifetime who's running for re-election likes to sign farm bills, loves the press opportunity, will go to a cornfield or a soybean field or wheat field somewhere to sign the bill. You've got a Senate chairwoman, Senator Stabenow, who was Senate chairwoman when I was chairman of the House and we did the 14 farm bill. Practical, tough, but realistic, who will retire from the United States Senate in 2025. This farm bill is her swan song, so she has an incentive not to do an extension, but to do a real bill. We've got Senator Bozeman, who's the ranking Republican in Arkansas. No more diverse agriculture in America than Arkansas. He understands all these issues. He wants to do a farm bill. And we served together in the House before he went to Senate, just as Debbie Stabenow and I served in the House. In the House side, you got G.T. Thompson. How many trips to the field, how many hearing sessions, how many listening sessions, I should say, did G.T. do over the course of this of his chairmanship to get ready for this? G.T. wants one. Now, G.T. has some health issues, but he's fighting that. I've got a ranking member in the form of David Scott, who may not be a dirt-under-your-fingernails kind of an Aggie, but I think he understands the comprehensive package because it's both programs to raise food and fiber, and it's also to make sure we can get enough calories out there for folks who are disadvantaged. He's got an incentive. So if the leadership, by that I mean the leadership in the House and leadership in the Senate, if we can get the appropriations bills done for this year and they can focus long enough to give us the resources we need, we can do this. But if we can't, then at some point going into late July, you're going to need another extension because producers and their landlords and their bankers and their spouses need some certainty again.
Given this political calendar and the time that legislators will be on the Hill, is it the end of March? Is it the end of April? Is it before the August recess? What does it say? And then I would have to believe post the election, it depends on how each chamber falls and who controls the key to the White House.
Oh, exactly. My preference on these sort of issues is to address it before we go home for August, because when we come back after Labor Day, there won't be that many weeks of session, and there won't be that much political oxygen, because remember, a third of the Senate, the entire United States House, and the presidential campaign will be going full blast into November. And campaigns seem to be getting shriller and louder and sillier as time goes by in this world we live in. If we can't do what has to be done by the first day of October, then we'll come back in after November for what is referred to as a lame duck session, because it's the old ladies and gentlemen, not the new ones, who then come the first Monday in January of 2025. I've seen some amazing things done in lame duck. I don't know for sure what to expect, but if you had a crystal ball, you would say there's a real chance of a change in presidential administration in November. There's a real chance in changing control of the United States Senate in November. In the House, the question is, can we, as Republicans in the majority, act like the majority and do our job? If we do, I think the voters will let us be a part of that Republican control. If we don't, then they're going to be unhappy.
Last week on this program, Senator Hovind of North Dakota lamented the fact that the Appropriations Committee had done its work. Their bills were approved, but they can't get to the floor. And if I follow his statement and adding on to comments that you've made before, until the details are filled in with each one of those bills, it's kind of hard to write policy anyway.
Oh, absolutely. The dysfunctionality is not really the appropriators. It's the overall leadership, it's the overall political environment giving the appropriators the tools they need. Again, remember when I was chairman for the 12 that became the 13 that became the 14 farm bill? My biggest enemy was not the Democrats or my fellow Republicans on the Ag Committee. And in some ways, it wasn't necessarily the majority of either of the conferences on the floor. But it was my friends in leadership, all of whom are gone now, And certain of my friends in the on the floor, in the majority, a few of who are still around, who are my tormentors. Yeah, it's the old adage. It's not your enemies. It's your friends that get you sometimes. But I overcame them. And we can overcome this time. It's just going to even be harder.
So the Freedom Caucus and those who are fiscally conservative, you have to look at the nation's deficit and say that some of their points are valid. Oh. But how can you go about it the right way? You're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't.
Well, I agree with my idealistic friends. We spend too much money. We're incurring too much debt. We're putting up too big a hangover in the future generations. But it's kind of like the old line about you don't burn the barn down till you have a plan to put it back up. And some of my most principled friends want to do shutdowns. They want to literally burn the federal government down. But when you press them, they can't tell you exactly how we'd reopen. They can't tell you exactly how we'd do this, that, and the other. I'm an old bull in the United States House, to use the political term when I first got there. I understand that there's more to what we're doing than just the next soundbite, or the next radio show, or the next TV show, or the next mail out back home. Some of my underclassmen friends, who've not been there particularly long, and maybe haven't paid as much attention as they should to what goes on, can't quite grasp next year or 5 years or 10 years or 15 years from now. On the Ag Committee, we've always worked in 5-year cycles on farm policy. I can tell you, in my present role as Science Committee Chairman, we're talking about things 25, 50, or 100 years down the road. That's kind of out of sync with this smartphone society we live in now, but you still have to look at things that way. My speaker, Speaker Johnson, one of the very principled conservatives, very conservative in everything he did. But when he became speaker, suddenly he's had to go through this process of growing up. You can vote no and hope yes, but sometimes when you're responsible, you got to get to yes.
Only takes one person to challenge that speaker position.
Yeah, that's a mistake. It was policy prior to when Nancy Pelosi became speaker, and she changed it. And when Kevin McCarthy and we Republicans took control again, we changed back to the old rule. But when you have right now, in the case of the United States House, for all practical purposes, there's only a 2-seat majority. There are only 2 more Republicans on a day-to-day basis than there are Democrats. If we have a bad snowstorm, airplane problems, if there's a funeral in a state, if somebody has a major medical problem or one of their beloved ones do, then we can't do anything. I don't think the founding fathers or mothers ever envisioned you'd be working with these margins. But again, that may be an example, Jeff, of where the voters in the country, after several very close elections in Congress and for president, maybe they need to decide where we're going and give us a clear instruction.
Senator Hovind also brought these numbers up, and he was talking about nutrition and in this new farm bill, suggesting that in the previous farm bill, nutrition was $600 billion. This one's projected at $1.2 trillion. And he said if we're going to spend more money on nutrition, then we need to give to agriculture what agriculture needs.
The Biden administration has done a dramatic job of loosening all the standards and accelerating the numbers, using some administrative authority that no one thought they ever would. And in all fairness, during the COVID issues, there was some flexibility given that had never been there before. So it's pushed up dramatically the spending. But as I always tell my colleagues in Congress, it doesn't matter how much money you put on those electronic benefit cards. If there's nothing on the shelf to buy, it doesn't matter. And that's where COVID was so important. Remember the effect it had on processing and packing plants, the fact that you would go to little stores and big stores, and for a time, there'd be nothing on the shelf. That was the first time most Americans ever went to a grocery store. It might have been hard to have the money in their pocket to buy, but there's always something on the shelf. But we saw for months at a time, when you couldn't buy what you wanted, you bought what you could get. I'm hoping that's a lesson my friends have learned. You have to invest in the production of food and fiber. You can't just invest in the consumption, because if there's nothing to buy, what good does that card do in their pocket?
Supreme Court of the United States, Chevron versus the Natural Resources Defense Council. The opportunity for an agency to not just interpret, but to write policy.
I think the Supreme Court, and I'm not an attorney, but I believe after four decades, they're getting ready potentially to reverse that. You can understand, perhaps 40 years ago when the standard was set, if the law was so vague, the court determined that you should turn to the agencies that are implementing the law to see what their intent is, and that would be the justification to move forward. But now we're in a world where the agencies are dominated by ideologues, and it depends on which administration you happen to have, which way they swing back and forth, that suddenly they're being manipulated in a way to produce a result that may not reflect or even been the remote intention of the basic law. Now, this will make more work for us, and it'll make more work for the agencies, but I think the court's headed in the right direction on this. Don't know when we'll get the ruling, but I do think it's coming.
It's been an issue that's been going on for a long time, but it's drawn to the surface lately of foreign investment in agriculture business, but also especially agriculture land.
Yep. My cohorts and I wrote a letter to the general GAO, which I'll provide you a copy of, which basically asked for a review of all of this sort of stuff, and they came back this last week with their report. 2001, we had 40 million acres of foreign investment in U.S. land. That number kind of took my breath away for just a moment. And it also noted that essentially the Biden administration is not tracking foreign land ownership and doesn't have a plan to. That got me, and noted that USDA needs to be able to collect, track, and share this kind of stuff. Because most land ownership prohibitions are state in nature. We have one of those in Oklahoma. But the state authorities have to know that the foreign land ownership exists and who the owner is before they can respond. And that's where I think USDA could do a better job of requiring this information to be made and getting it to my state authorities' hands so they could enforce state law.
You have legislation that would include the agriculture secretary.
Oh, absolutely. There's something called CFIUS, and I won't go through all of the words that go with the title, but it was an entity created back in the 1970s to make sure that no foreign government, no foreign entity, no foreign individual would acquire control of major elements of the American society that would affect national defense. First blush, you can think of rocket factories or computer factories or shipbuilding yards or that sort of stuff. I've argued for a number of years, and this has only really come to a boil in the last couple of years, that food is a national security issue and that the Secretary of Ag should be on that board too. And that when, as we've sometimes seen, assets in the United States that get sold to an entity somewhere who then turns around and sells it to another entity, and it winds up in the control of what I would probably define as our economic and political enemies, we shouldn't allow that to happen. But until you have the Secretary of Ag on there, and I've discussed this with Secretary Vilsack in an open Ag committee hearing, and he is willing to be on the board. He just needs the statutory authority there so he can be on the board, and we're pushing hard on that. And I would hope that my friends will maintain their momentum.
Coming back to regulation for a second here, I think your state and some others are favorable to the petroleum industry.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some other states that are pretty favorable to renewable fuel.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Environmental Protection Agency and their recent proposal for tailpipe emissions, it would control and determine what automobile manufacturers provide for customers, whether they want it or not.
You remember the old, was it the Thomas Jefferson line, the power to tax is the power to kill? Well, in our day and age, it's the power to regulate. And clearly this administration, with their concepts about social justice and environmental justice, mean to change how we consume our energy in this country. Again, let me put my science hat on here. The ultimate answer is fusion power. When we use the mechanics of the sun to combine atoms, not split them, that's where we're going. But that may be 5, 50, 150 years away. We have to survive until we get there. I'm from electric windmill state. We're going to be huge into solar panels. We're tremendous on crude oil, but even more so on natural gas. There's things like natural gas where you have a transition fuel that is dramatically cleaner than some of the other fossil fuels, but you have to be willing to use it. And that means letting us drill, letting us lay pipelines, letting us deliver. That's why natural gas is probably the key element as to why emissions in the United States have gone down in the last 20 years. Actually gone down. So let me use my natural gas. And towards my other friends, ethanol and all those sort of issues, I'm in favor of accessing everything we have. And as I occasionally remind folks back home in Oklahoma, there is such a huge percentage of the corn crop that goes to the ethanol cookers now. And it also oxygenates the gasoline, makes it burn cleaner, that you have to maintain this ethanol production. Otherwise, you take down the price of wheat, you take down beans and corn and barley and oats and rice and everything else with it. And I need price stability, not price calamity.
I'll bring us to a conclusion here. Since you brought up taxes, there was a tax deal, as I understand, that has been offered recently in Washington. But looking down the road, the estate tax is coming back.
Yes. No greater devil than a tax on capital and the work of generations, which is basically what the death tax is. This is why the November election is so important, because we can't just snap back to where we were before. Think of the inflation effect on farmland, not just in Oklahoma, but Indiana, Georgia, California, wherever. If we go back to where we were after the inflation that's been brought on by the decisions during COVID and the Biden administration, we'll wind up wiping out an entire generation of people. I watched when the farm economy collapsed in 1982, all of what I referred to as my Vietnam generation farmers at home in my home county, who were maximum debt, maximum leverage, ceased to exist. I don't want to go through a gyration to do that to this generation of 20 and 30 and 40 year olds.
Congressman Lucas, congratulations on your award from the American Farm Bureau Federation. And from agriculture, thank you for your service, your undying service in the face of headwinds. Thanks for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. It is Open Mic, and today that microphone's yours.
Let me simply say, I appreciate my Farm Bureau neighbors and fellow members for their congratulations today. I would note, this doesn't mean that the struggle is over with. We have to finish the 24 Farm Bill. We have to lay the groundwork for what will hopefully be the 29 Farm Bill, to make the investments in infrastructure and research and science that will make the 34 Farm Bill simpler and the 39 Farm Bill simpler. I may not be around for the 39 Farm Bill, but I want to do everything I can in the time that Linda Lucas, my wife, and the voters of the 3rd District will allow me to be there on their behalf. It's been a heck of a ride, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world, even though it turned my hair gray and I now take high blood pressure pills. That's called the 2014 Farm Bill, Jeff. But nonetheless, we've done some good. In an ever more chaotic world, it seems, we've done some good.
Our thanks to former House Ag Committee Chairman and Oklahoma 3rd District Representative Frank Lucas, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.